The portions of his wealth he and Halcombe had carefully diverted through charitable donations to the churches and monastic communities which shared his religious views, like St. Hamlin's in Rivermouth, had become a critically important element in the bishop's ability to successfully create, supply, and arm his temple loyalist organization. Halcombe hadn't been entirely happy about the fact that Kyrie and Halbrook Hollow had become open friends, but he'd realized that the relationship had its advantages as well as its drawbacks. And given the fact that the Duke's unhappiness with his niece's marriage and policies was well known, it had probably been inevitable that someone as wealthy and politically prominent as Kyrie, who was known to share his unhappiness, should become one of his relatively few friendly associates in Carus. Neither man was prepared to openly condemn their monarch's policies, but there had to be a perfectly understandable comfort zone in their shared views. Besides, Halbrook Hollow had invested heavily in Kyrie's various enterprises, and the two of them shared many of the same interests in horses and hunting, and Kyrie had made his hunting lodge available to introduce his new friend to the game animals of Carus. In the end, Halcombe had decided that Kyrie was right. It would have looked even more suspicious if the two men hadn't become friends. And since everyone knew they were both avid hunters, the Duke's decision to visit Kyrie's lodge once again, especially while the Empress was out of town anyway, was actually perfectly reasonable. Or would have been if the timing had been a bit different, at any rate. The fact that Halbrook Hollow had used the schooner Sunrise for his transport from Kyrie's hunting lodge in the neighboring earldom of Stiven to Tricare Bay was another of the very few positive elements in the Duke's incredibly stupid decision to travel outside Telisburg at this particular moment. Sunrise was one of Kyrie's vessels, and she'd been used to make several Temple Loyalist deliveries in and around Howell Bay. Her crew had already demonstrated both its loyalty and its ability to keep its collective mouth shut. None of which changed the fact that Halbrook Hollow had been supposed to be staying in Telisburg Palace, where he'd have a cast-iron alibi when news of the attack on St. Agatha's arrived. And, of course, there was the minor fact that Sunrise had now sailed into Tricare Bay right by a galleon of the Imperial Carisian Navy. Which, given what was about to happen at St. Agatha's, meant she was bound to come under intense scrutiny eventually, and that raised all sorts of unpleasant possibilities of its own. "Your Grace," the bishop said after a moment, "I understand why you might feel anxious, but in my opinion this was still an ill-advised decision on your part. Too many things have the potential to go wrong."
"Which is precisely why I'm here."
The Duke's mouth twisted in a parody of a smile.
"I know how high feelings are running among our people. I want to be here to be sure they behave themselves with proper restraint. Charlian never needs to know I was here, but I need to know that she's all right."
"I see."
Halcombe nodded slowly, then seated himself once again at the kitchen table, facing the door. He waved one hand at the second chair, across the table from his own, and Halbrook Hollow sat down. Then the bishop glanced over his visitor's shoulder at Shumay.
"Alvin, in light of his grace's concerns, could you ask Mitron to step in here? Go ahead and tell him the Duke is here and..."
He paused and looked at Halbrook Hollow.
"I assume you brought at least one or two of your own armsmen, Your Grace?"
"Two of them," Halbrook Hollow nodded.
"Don't worry, both of them have been with me for at least 20 years.
"Good."
Halcombe turned back to Shumay.
"Tell Mitron to see to any of His Grace's armsmen's needs as well."
"Of course, my lord," Shumay murmured,
his face expressionless, and stepped out of the kitchen.
"Your Grace,"
Halcombe continued as the young priest withdrew,
"as I say, I understand the basis for your anxiety, and I suppose I can't fault you for your desire to ensure your niece's safety. Still, it would have been better if you'd been able to trust me to see to that while you remained in Telesburg. All of our plans and strategy were built upon your being there in the palace when news of this arrived."
"I realize that," Halbrook Hollow said just a bit shortly. "The original plan was mine, after all. But Trevir is prepared to cover for me, and the fact that I'm already right next door in Stiven will get me to the scene much more rapidly. The fact that I'm already here before Grey Harbor or anyone else from Telesburg can arrive will give me the opportunity to establish contact with Charlian's abductors before they do, too. It'll be much harder for them to try to ease me aside if I'm already conducting negotiations before they ever get here." Halcombe nodded slowly, although he recognized the sound of someone rationalizing a decision he'd actually made for quite different reasons. As rationalizations went, though, the bishop was forced to admit, it wasn't bad. Halbrook Hollow's plan for Charlian's abduction by Carisian elements, hostile to the merger of Karis and Chisholm, had been designed to deal Chisholm's faith in Karis a mortal blow. If the Carisians couldn't even bother themselves to adequately protect Chisholm's queen from their own lunatic fringe, the backlash in Chisholm would almost certainly be severe. Not only that, it would be most severe among Chisholm's commoners, the ones most likely to resist any machinations among the kingdom's aristocracy. Halbrook Hollow's freely expressed reservations about the wisdom of her marriage, on the other hand, would be amply vindicated, and as the senior Chisholmian noble in Karis, not to mention his status as Charlian's uncle and the man who still officially commanded the royal army, he would inevitably be deeply involved in any negotiations with her captors. Even if someone like Grey Harbor might be tempted to exclude him, they would realize that the political consequences in Chisholm would be disastrous. The demands of those captors would be extreme, but not impossibly so for someone determined to get his beloved niece back alive. The Duke would agree, in Charlian's name, to withdraw Chisholmian support for the schism between the Temple and the Church of Karis, but only if she was returned to him alive. If his Carisian fellow negotiators objected, he would point out that Charlian could always countermand his own agreement later, but that for her to do that, they first had to get her back. Once the critical point had been conceded, the abductors would agree to return Charlian to Halbrook Hollow's custody, but not in Karis. She would be delivered in Chisholm, which would naturally require Halbrook Hollow to return to Tirith in person. And Halbrook Hollow would arrive sufficiently in advance of her return to engineer the downfall of Baron Greenmountain and Queen Mother Alana's regency, which would inevitably have been weakened by the proof of just how unwise the alliance with Karis had actually been in the first place. He'd have to be careful about exactly how he managed that, but given command of the army, it shouldn't prove impossibly difficult. Especially not when he accepted his old friend Green Mountain's resignation as first counselor, with obvious sorrow and regret, and solely because it was part of the abductor's demands. Halbrook Hollow had no doubt that with Green Mountain out of the way, the more conservative and ambitious of Charlian's nobles would be prepared to reach a quiet, unspoken understanding with him, despite any past animosity. By the time Charlian herself arrived in Chisholm, he and his newfound allies would be firmly in control, at which point Charlian would find herself comfortably but securely, and very discreetly, under house arrest, while Halbrook Hollow put her new policies into effect. Unfortunately, as Halcombe had pointed out to Shumay, The plan would never work, not in the long run. Which was why he had contrived his own quite different strategy. And irritated as the bishop had been by Halbrook Hollow's unexpected arrival, more mature consideration showed him the hand of God behind the Duke's foolish decision. After all, his response to what they actually intended had always been problematical at best, whereas now...
"I see your reasoning, Your Grace," Halcombe said in a slightly regretful tone, as Mitron Divis, one of the Temple Loyalists' group leaders, stepped through the kitchen door behind the seated Halbrook Hollow.
"And, under the circumstances, it may not be an entirely bad thing you decided to come."
"I'm glad you can see it my way," Halbrook Hollow said. "Now, it's important, as I say, that Charlian never realize I was here. So..."
His voice died in a hideous gurgle as Divis seized his hair, yanked his head back, and slashed his throat. Halcombe pushed back from the table with a grimace of distaste as the flood of blood splashed across it. Some of the spray pattern pattered across his own tunic, and his grimace deepened. He dabbed at it instinctively, but his gaze never left Halbrook Hollow's face as the Duke's eyes flared wide in horrified surprise, and then lost all expression forever.
"I'm sorry, Your Grace," Halcombe said softly, reaching across the table to close the dead man's eyes. "But it truly is best this way, I think."
He drew a deep breath, suppressing an urge to gag as the coppery stink of blood and the stench of voided bowels filled the kitchen, and looked at Divis.
"I'm sorry we had to do that, Mitron. He may have been a foolish man, and we all know he had personal political ambitions as well. But he was also a son of Mother Church."
Divis nodded, wiping his dagger clean on the Duke's tunic, then cocked an eyebrow. "What should we do with the body, my lord?" he asked pragmatically.
"We're going to have to give that some thought," Halcombe admitted. "I'm inclined to the theory that it might be best for him to simply disappear, perhaps another victim of the Carisian assassins. That will depend on how effectively Master Kyrie has managed to cover himself, and exactly what the Duke told people in Telesburg he intended to do. For now, put him with his armsmen."
14. The Convent of St. Agatha, Earldom of Crest Hollow, Kingdom of Carus. The marksman who'd killed Willis Geralt stayed very still. The opportunity to pick off the commander of Charlian's bodyguards had been an unanticipated gift from God, and he'd taken it without any order to do so. The captain would have had to die in the end anyway, of course. There could be no survivors of this night's work. But the possibility that he might have cried out, or that one of his own men might have seen him fall, had been very real. On the other hand, the range had been less than 40 yards, and the marksman hadn't missed a shot at that range since he was a boy. The odds had favored a silent kill in his judgment, and the elimination of the bodyguard's central authority had struck him as well worth the risk. He listened intently and heard nothing but the grumble of more thunder from the west and the sound of pre-storm wind sighing through the trees about him. Good, he thought, and carefully and quietly re-spanned the arbalist. Edward Seahamper glanced up at the sky with a frown as full darkness settled over St. Agatha's. The convent's grounds were dimly illuminated by the candlelight spilling out of various windows, and the convent chapel's stained glass glowed warmly. The windows' patterns were simple, as became a convent dedicated to a saint who'd embraced a life of asceticism and vows of poverty and service, but the colors were richly vibrant.
"And they won't do a thing for my night vision,"
he thought grumpily. There was just enough light to make the shadows even more impenetrable, and that was going to grow still worse, unless he missed his guess, once the rain began to fall in earnest.
"Of course I'll be able to see just fine during the lightning flashes."
His frown turned into a grimace at that particular thought. Contemplating the effect rain was going to have on little things like mail hauberks, cuirasses, sword blades, pistols, rifle barrels, and bayonets, and anything else made of steel didn't make him feel significantly better somehow. Still, he'd been rained on before, and he'd never shrunk yet. He shrugged that concern aside and returned to the thought which had occasioned his frown in the first place. Captain Garrott should have been back half an hour ago. The captain was an energetic man who was disinclined to waste time. By now, he'd had time to hike clear around the convent twice, but there was no sign of him.
"He probably found someone he thought needed a little counseling," Seahamper thought. "God help anyone he thinks is slacking off on this detail. On the other hand, who'd be stupid enough to do that in the first place?"
His frown returned, deeper than before, and he glanced at Sergeant Ternier. Ternier, another Chisomian, had been with the Empress for the last 8 years, which had made him the logical man to share Seahamper's watch here at the guesthouse door.
"I wonder what's keeping the captain,"
Seahamper wondered out loud.
"I was just thinking the same thing," Turner replied.
"It's probably nothing, but it's not like him," Seahamper continued. "Trot over to the main gate, Brendan. See if he's over there."
"If he isn't?"
"Then make a circuit yourself. No, wait. If they haven't seen him, ask the lieutenant to send one of the others around the circuit looking for him while you come back here."
"Got it,"
Ternier acknowledged laconically, and went jogging off across the convent's manicured grass. The man crouched in the meadow just beyond the orchard came slowly upright once full darkness had fallen. Nihlus Larocque's face had been blackened, and his dark clothing blended seamlessly into the night about him. No one could possibly have seen him from more than a very few yards away. In fact, Larocque himself couldn't see the other men out here under his command. Not that he was worried about them. He didn't have to see them to know where they were, given how often they'd rehearsed this particular task. There'd been no way to predict with certainty where the Empress's bodyguards would bivouac, but Larocque was an experienced hunter and woodsman who'd grown up less than 4 miles from St. Agatha's, and he was intimately familiar with the convent's grounds. He'd known it would be impossible for the abbess to house them inside the convent proper, and this had been by far the most logical place for them to pitch their tents outside its wall. There'd been 2 other possibilities, and they'd rehearsed attacks on those locations as well, yet he'd been confident in his own mind that this would be the one that actually got carried out. Now he took a small object from his pocket and raised it to his lips. A moment later, the plaintive whistling call of a gray-horned wyvern floated through the night. The nocturnal hunter called 3 times, and somewhere in the windy darkness, another greyhorn replied. Captain Garrott had posted sentries around his bivouac area, as well as around the convent itself, and those sentries hadn't been chosen for their lack of vigilance. They stood their posts alertly, yet they would have been more than human if they'd actually expected an attack, especially an attack on their own encampment rather than a direct strike at the Empress. Their planning and training included the notion that the first move in an attack might be to neutralize their reserve force, but few of them had truly anticipated that level of sophistication or planning out of the sort of lunatics likely to launch a direct assault on Charlian or Caleb. Unfortunately, they weren't dealing with lunatics. Only fanatics. The sentries scanned the night around them attentively, yet they saw nothing. The men creeping steadily towards them through the darkness were effectively invisible, but they'd carefully located their own targets before darkness fell. They knew exactly where to find the sentries, and the guardsmen were backlit, however faintly, by their fellows' cooking fires. For some minutes after the night-hunting wyverns had called to one another, nothing else happened. Then, abruptly, quite a lot of things happened, almost simultaneously. The sudden whip-crack of a firing rifle split the night. The sentry who'd seen his attacker at the last moment not only managed to get off his shot, but hit the other man squarely in the chest. Unfortunately, the accuracy of his single shot didn't do a thing to the other two temple loyalists detailed to neutralize his position.
"Post three! Post three!"
he shouted, identifying his post, but before he could complete the announcement, the other two were upon him. His rifle blocked the slash of the first man's sword, and a quick savage riposte with the rifle butt knocked the attacker back on his heels, winning him just enough time to thrust with his bayonet at the other man. The second temple loyalist tried to twist aside, but he couldn't completely avoid the bayonet, and he groaned in anguish as the bitter steel slammed between his ribs. He went down, yet even as the guardsman started to recover his bayonet, the swordsman whose first attack he'd deflected drove 2 feet of steel through his own throat. None of the other sentries even saw their attackers. Two of them were turning towards the blinding muzzle flash of the first guardsman's rifle when their own assailants flowed over them. The other six were already too busy dying to even register that single shot. Shouts of alarm came from the bivouac area, and someone began barking harsh-voiced orders as armsmen scrambled out of their tents, dropped eating utensils, sprang to their feet, and snatched for weapons. The men of the Imperial Guard responded quickly, almost instantly, with the discipline of unceasing training and hard-won experience. Yet for all the quickness with which they reacted, they were too slow. They were still scrambling for their mental balance, fighting past the stunned shock of complete surprise, when twice their own number of armed, disciplined assailants swarmed into their encampment. Only a handful of the off-duty guardsmen were armored, and all of them were scattered about the bivouac area, where they'd been engaged in the routine homey tasks of tending to their equipment, finishing their suppers, and preparing to get some rest before it was their turn to take over the duty watch. The temple loyalists were concentrated, moving in purposeful teams, and they went through the camp like a hurricane. Men cursed, grunted, and cried out as weapons struck, and those of the guardsmen who'd managed to grab their own weapons fought back desperately. Men screamed as steel bit deep, or as the rifle butts of guardsmen who hadn't had time to load crushed flesh and bone. The night was hideous, with the sounds of men slaughtering one another. And then, as abruptly as it had begun, it was over. The meadow was littered with bodies, most of them in the livery of the Empire of Karras. 35 of Charlian's bodyguards had been brutally eliminated at the cost of 4 dead and 6 wounded temple loyalists.
Langhorn!
Sergeant Seahamper's face went white at the sudden explosion of carnage beyond the convent's wall. Despite his niggling concern over Captain Geralt's tardiness, he'd no more expected an attack like this than anyone else. But Edward Seahamper hadn't been his monarch's personal armsman for so many years for nothing.
"Rally!"
he heard his own voice shouting.
"Rally!"
Other voices shouted back, but not as many of them as he should have heard. The other groups of attackers had gotten as close as they could to the duty sentries, yet they dared not get too close until the bivouac had been attacked. They'd waited, straining at the leash of discipline and their orders, until the abrupt sound of that single rifle shot launched them at the guardsmen they'd been able to locate. Half a dozen arbalest strings snapped, but this time the darkness was the guardsman's friend, and, despite the short range, most of the bolts missed their targets. Not all of them did, but the sentries, unlike their comrades in the encampment, had anticipated that any attack on the Empress would begin with an effort to neutralize them. That was why they'd chosen their positions so carefully. Despite the intensity with which the Temple Loyalists had observed the convent since Charlian's arrival, they'd been unable to locate all of the guard posts outside the wall. The moving sentries had been relatively easy to spot as they paced back and forth, but the others were another matter. Under the circumstances, the attackers had no choice but to rely on their superior numbers and the fact that they knew approximately where any guards had to be stationed, even if they didn't know their exact locations. And, unlike the sentries, they'd known the attack was coming. When the rifle shots split the night, they were poised and ready, and the night outside St. Agatha's erupted in small, ugly knots of violence as they tried to rush the gates. They failed. Even taken by surprise, the men charged with protecting Empress Charlian struck back hard. Although the Imperial Guard had adopted the rifle as its primary weapon, its men knew better than to give away their positions by firing. Instead, they demonstrated to their enemies just how lethally effective a bayonet could be. The guard was equipped with the same weapon as the Marine Scout Snipers, with the same 14-inch bayonets, and they used the reach advantage of their weapon's length ruthlessly. Temple Loyalists screamed as guardsmen appeared abruptly before or behind them, and they suddenly found themselves transfixed by knife-edged blades of tempered steel. Unlike the surprised guardsmen in the encampment, the sentries formed coordinated teams, operating with the smoothness of long training and familiarity, and the initial assault on the main gate and on the smaller gate in the western wall failed. The one on the northern gate was another matter. The heavy woodland had allowed the Temple Loyalists detailed for that attack to get much closer before darkness fell. They had a clearer idea of where their enemies were located, and they charged furiously, prepared to accept their own losses if they could close quickly with the guardsmen. They succeeded. Almost. All 8 sentries on the northern wall died, but 11 more Temple Loyalists died with them. And before the sergeant commanding the detachment went down, he turned and threw the gate key over the wall. The senior surviving attacker screamed in frustration as he realized the stout iron gate was locked, but he wasted no time trying to batter his way through it. Instead, he and his remaining men turned and ran towards the western gate. The 10-man reserve Captain Garrott had posted just outside the convent chapter house reacted almost instantly to Seahamper's shout. They knew the drill for responding to a surprise attack as well as the sergeant did, and they closed in around the guest house in automatic reaction. It was their job to ensure the Empress's safety first, rather than allowing themselves to be diverted into racing towards apparent threats which might well turn out to be diversions. Once the center was secure, they could move to reinforce the perimeter. The 8 men on the western gate killed 18 Temple Loyalists at the cost of 5 of their own. The sergeant commanding the detail and one of his 2 surviving troopers were both wounded, but they managed to retreat through the gate and lock it behind them before the surviving attackers could get themselves reorganized for another attempt. The three guardsmen fell back to join the reserve around the guesthouse, even as rifle fire began to crackle at the main gate. Lieutenant Hoskin had been waiting for Captain Garrott with increasing impatience. He, too, had begun wondering what could have been keeping Garrott, even before Ternier arrived at the main gate with Sea Hamper's message, but he'd no more suspected his commanding officer might already be dead than Sea Hamper had. That didn't keep him from reacting quickly. He'd recognized the sound of the initial rifle shot even before he heard Sea Hamper shouting the alarm, and he and his men knew precisely what to do. Just as the reserve's initial responsibility was to surround the Empress and be certain she was secure, the perimeter team's responsibility was to hold their positions at least until the situation had clarified. The 10 men of Lieutenant Hoskins' detachment didn't need him to tell them that. They didn't need him to tell them how to do it either, because he and Garrott had walked the entire perimeter together immediately after their arrival. They'd discussed contingency plans for each position and briefed their men on exactly what they were supposed to do under each of those plans, and now the men on the gate put that briefing into action. Unlike the guards' other positions, the approach to the convent's main gate was relatively well illuminated, and Hoskin had positioned additional lanterns farther down the approach lane, along both sides, to extend the reach of the existing lighting. Because of that, the temple loyalists assigned to seize the gate had found it impossible to work their way as close as their fellows had managed to do at the other gates. They had farther to go, which gave the guardsmen more time to realize what was happening, and when they charged, they met the accurate fire of 10 rifles at point-blank range. A third of them went down, thrashing and screaming. The others continued their charge, but the sudden carnage in their own ranks had half-stunned them and shattered their formation. This time, it was the guardsmen who met the shock of combat unshaken, and their white-hot fury and the reach of their weapons proved decisive. Only one of them was lightly wounded, and the handful of surviving temple loyalists fell back, leaving the approach to the gate carpeted with the bodies of their fellows. "Sergeant Ternier," Hoskin snapped while the gate detachment reloaded quickly. "Get back to Sergeant Sea Hamper and make sure the Empress is safe."
"Yes, sir."
The sergeant dashed towards the guest house, and Hoskin turned to his senior non-com.
"Check the other gates," he said. "Then report back here."
"Yes, sir."
The second sergeant saluted quickly and disappeared into the darkness, and Hoskin looked at the remaining members of his detachment.
"All right, boys," he said grimly. "I don't know who these bastards are, but there's Shan Wei's own lot of them. Fall back behind the gate."
Faces tightened as his men realized what he was saying. They and the other perimeter guards were supposed to be the reaction force, the ones who counterattacked once the situation had been stabilized. Closing and locking the gate behind them was an explicit admission that they were too outnumbered to consider taking the fight to the other side.
"Shan Wei, take it!"
Charles Abelin swore viciously as he surveyed the bodies sprawled outside the convent's main gate. The carefully worked-out plan had visualized getting inside in the first rush, where the temple loyalists could get to grips with the entire strength of Charlian's bodyguards while the guardsmen were still stunned by the sudden surprise attack. The last thing they needed was to allow troops of the Imperial Guard's caliber to recover from their initial shock and confusion. Unlike some of his fellows, Abelin had always had his reservations about the likelihood of successfully rushing the gates. Yet even at his most pessimistic, he hadn't anticipated the carnage Lieutenant Hoskins' men had wreaked. He didn't know how well the attacks on the other gates had gone, although it was obvious they hadn't broken through, nor did he know, yet, how well the attack on the bivouac area had gone. If the other prongs of the assault had taken casualties as heavy as his, however... He looked up as a runner dashed up to his position. He recognized the newcomer as one of Nihilus Larrock's men, although he didn't know his name.
"Well?" he asked sharply.
"Their camp's gone," the runner panted, his expression fierce with triumph in the dim glow spilling from the gateway's distant lanterns.
"All of them dead!"
Abelin grunted in satisfaction. Although he didn't share the other man's obvious pleasure at the death of men who were only doing their duty, however mistaken their loyalties might have been, at least he could be confident the other half of the Empress's bodyguards weren't going to come swarming up his backside while he dealt with the ones in front of him.
"Where's Nihilus?"
"On his way."
The runner's breathing was beginning to slow down, and he wiped sweat from his forehead.
"We lost a few men of our own, and he's reorganizing. He'll be here shortly."
"That's good,"
Abelin said sourly, and waved one hand at the locked gates.
"As you can see, we lost more than a few men. I haven't heard anything from the other gates yet, but it's pretty damned obvious they didn't break through either. It looks like we're going to have to do it the hard way after all."
The runner's face tightened as he followed Abelin's gesture, and the sprawled bodies of his fellow Temple Loyalists finally registered.
"God damn them!"
the man hissed venomously.
"Whatever else we may think of them, they're doing their duty as they understand it, and they'll do it well,"
Abelin said sharply. The runner looked at him, and Abelin shook his head.
"Don't make the mistake of thinking anything else, not unless you really want to die out here tonight."
"Edward!"
Sergeant Seahamper turned towards the soprano voice. Empress Charlian stood in the guesthouse door, fully dressed, her expression strained, with Carlson Reyes at her side, and he stepped quickly towards her.
"I don't know yet, Your Majesty," he said,
answering the unspoken question in her eyes, and his voice was grim.
"We don't know anything yet. But I'd just sent Brynden off to the main gate to find out if anyone had seen Captain Garat when all hell broke loose. From the sound of things, there have to be a lot of them. I think they hit the bivouac first, and I don't hear any more sounds of fighting from there."
The skin around her eyes tightened, but she didn't flinch, and he felt a surge of pride in her.
"I think we must have held at the gates, or they'd already be here,"
he continued, offering her the unvarnished truth.
"But there's no way we have enough manpower to keep them from getting over the wall somewhere if there are enough of them. I expect to see Lieutenant Huskin shortly. In the meantime, please stay inside, and blow out as many of your candles as you can. I don't know for certain that there aren't marksmen already out there on the ground somewhere, and I'd rather not give them lighted windows to silhouette targets for them."
Thunder crashed louder, rapidly approaching from the west, and the first sudden sheets of a Carisian deluge pummeled down from the heavens. Charles Abelin heard someone swearing in disgust, but he himself breathed a quiet prayer of thanks as he recognized the divine intervention on their behalf. The rain was bound to soak the priming of the guards' rifles, and as far as he was concerned, that was one of the best things that could possibly happen.
"Thank Langhorne for the rain,"
someone else bawled into his ear over the sudden tumult of rain and wind, as if to confirm his own thoughts. He turned his head and saw Nihilus Larrock.
"Amen,"
Abelin said fervently, then leaned closer to the other man.
"Your runner said you took the camp?"
"A clean sweep," Larrock showed his teeth. "We've confirmed the body count, and as nearly as I can tell, only three or four of them managed to get inside on the other two gates."
"And how many did we lose?"
"I'm not sure,"
Larock replied, his voice harsher.
Not counting yours here. More than 20, less than 40, I think. I'll know better in a few minutes. We're still coming in and getting sorted out.
Their eyes met. They'd anticipated losses of their own, and they and their men were prepared to pay whatever price was demanded of them. But losses that heavy this early were more than merely painful.
Mitron will be here with his people shortly, Avalyn said.
I don't like waiting, giving them time to get set in there, Larock objected.
I don't either, but we've already lost almost as many men as they have, and if we're going to have to go over the wall, I want enough people on our side to be damn sure we can spread them too thin to stop us when we do. And we're going to need all the swords we can get once we get to the other side, too.
Larock's expression was sour, but he grunted in unhappy agreement.
In that case, he said, let's get our people reorganized while we wait.
Edward Seahamper completed his nose count as torrents of rain lashed the convent's grounds. He'd sent a runner to the abbess, warning her to take the sisters to the chapel and keep them there out of harm's way. He wished he could have provided them with better security than that, but he was spread far too thinly to even think about that.
I make it 13, plus the 2 wounded, he said to Brynden Ternier, who'd returned from the main gate.
Plus the 10 with the lieutenant, Ternier agreed.
So, 26.
25, Ternier corrected flatly. George isn't going to make it. He's coughing up blood.
Seahamper swore softly. Sergeant George Simon was the Carisian-born guardsman who had commanded the picket on the west gate. He'd not only held it long enough to get his surviving men back to the guest house, but he'd managed to bring all of the picket's rifles as well. Yet Seahamper couldn't afford to dwell on the knowledge that another good man was dying. He couldn't even take the time to go tell a man who'd become his friend goodbye.
25, then, he said harshly, and the two guardsmen looked at one another grim-faced.
That was less than a third of their original strength, and they had no illusions about what had happened to any of their unaccounted-for fellows.
I think we need the lieutenant here, Seahamper said. Why don't you go and...
Why don't you stay right where you are instead?
Another voice interrupted, and Seahamper looked up to see Lieutenant Hoskin. Rain streamed from the rim of the officer's helmet, and the other guardsmen with him were equally sodden-looking. But Seahamper had never seen a more welcome sight.
Good to see you, Lieutenant,
he said with commendable understatement, and Hoskin smiled grimly.
Sergeant, if you think anything about this situation is good, you and I need to have a little talk, the Carisian said.
I meant relatively good, sir.
Well, that's a relief.
Hoskin's smile broadened fleetingly, then vanished.
The Empress?
Inside.
Seahamper twitched his head at the small guest house.
She knows what's happening?
As well as any of us do, sir.
It isn't good, Edward, Hoskin said more quietly, his voice barely carrying to the sergeant through the sound of wind and rain. I don't think they've given up just because we managed to bloody their nose at the gates. I think they're reorganizing, maybe rethinking, but they aren't going to just turn around and walk away. Not unless we manage to hurt them one hell of a lot worse than I think we did.
No, sir,
Seahamper agreed harshly.
I thought about sending a runner to Captain Hywitt, the lieutenant said even more quietly.
His eyes met Seahamper's.
I didn't.
Seahamper nodded, his face bleak. The odds would have been against any runners making it through the attackers who'd undoubtedly surrounded the convent. And even if someone could have accomplished that miracle, whatever was going to happen would undoubtedly be over and done before he could cover the 11 miles to the galleon, anchored in the small port which served St. Agatha's, and bring back a relief force.
All right, Sergeant.
Hoskin inhaled deeply.
I'll take charge of the outer perimeter. You've got the inner perimeter. And watch yourself, Edward. If it all comes apart on us, you're the one she's going to be looking for, the one she's most likely to listen to.
He looked deep into Seahamper's eyes, his own eyes bleak.
Keep her alive, he said. Whatever you have to do, keep her alive.
It's a good thing you insisted on more men, my lord, Mitran Divis told Bishop Miles grimly. The bishop and Father Alvin had arrived some minutes after Divis himself, and they were as thoroughly soaked as any of the others. The bishop's teeth chattered lightly as the rain and wind chilled him, and his expression was strained as the gateway lanterns and occasional lightning flashes showed him the bodies of Abelin's dead sprawled motionless in the rain. The sight chilled his heart far more thoroughly than the storm chilled his flesh.
Stop that, Miles, he told himself. You knew what it was going to be like before you ever set your hand to it. No one promised you that doing God's will would be easy or cheap. What happens next? He asked out loud.
Nihlus and Charles are about done sorting out their men, Divis told him. They're down to only about 70 between them, but my people are still intact. We'll take the lead. Miles Holcomb nodded, but his face was tight. If Larrach and Abelin had only 70 men left, then their attack teams had already lost well over half their original strength.
All right, Mitran, he agreed. God knows you're better equipped to manage this sort of thing than I am.
You just concentrate on putting in a good word with him for us, my lord, Divis said. We'll take care of the rest. Andrei Hoskin had positioned his remaining men as carefully as he could. He couldn't disperse them too widely, especially not in the middle of a booming thunderstorm, where visibility was measured in feet, not yards. Unit cohesion could vanish effortlessly under those conditions, and the one thing he was certain of was that he and his men were badly outnumbered. He couldn't afford to let this disintegrate into an uncoordinated melee. Nor could he count on their rifles and pistols to fire in the midst of such a downpour, even assuming they'd been able to see well enough to pick out targets. It was going to come down to cold steel, and that meant making his stand around the guesthouse itself. He'd considered moving the Empress into the main chapter house, but he'd quickly rejected that possibility. First, the chapter house's apparent defensibility was deceptive. Its walls were relatively thin, it had too many windows and doors, its internal architecture would have divided his guardsmen into isolated detachments, and he didn't have enough men to cover all the potential access points. Second, he was positive the Empress would have refused to endanger the nuns. If not for the first set of considerations, he would have been quite prepared to haul Charlian bodily to the safest possible place and take his chances on her displeasure in the event of his own survival. Unfortunately, the guest house was the safest possible place, such as it was and what there was of it. On the limited plus side, the guest house stood well away from any of the convent's walls. Anyone who wanted to attack it would have to cross the manicured grounds, which would provide them with no concealment or cover, although the poor visibility tended to cancel that particular defensive advantage. During the respite, while the other side was obviously reorganizing, Hoskin and Seahamper did their best to improve their positions. St. Agatha's offered little to work with, but the sisters' 3 farm wagons and pair of carts had been dragged out of the stables and turned upside down to form a rude strong point, covering the guest house's single door, and the walls of an outbuilding near the stable yard had been quickly demolished. The loose stone provided far too little building material for any sort of breastwork,
but Seahamper had seen to it that individual rocks were scattered all around their position. It wasn't as good as Caltrip's would have been, but in the darkness, those unexpected, all but invisible lumps of rock were guaranteed to come as unpleasant surprises to charging men. Now, the surviving guardsmen waited. All of them were veterans who could compute the odds against them just as well as Hoskin or Seahamper. They knew what was going to happen in the end, if there were enough attackers out there to continue the assault, and their faces were grim as they thought about the life of the young woman behind them. Empress Charlian looked up quickly as Edward Seahamper stepped into the plainly furnished, dimly lit guesthouse bedchamber. Water dripped from her personal armsman's cuirass and helmet, droplets pattering on the stone floor, and she recognized the stark desperation restrained by discipline in his eyes. "How bad is it, Edward?" she asked quietly.
"About as bad as it could be, Your Majesty."
His expression was grim.
"I'm pretty sure Captain Geralt must be dead."
Charlian winced in pain, but not in surprise, and he continued unflinchingly.
"Lieutenant Hoskins in command now, but we're down to 25 men, and we don't know how many we're up against or how badly we may have hurt them. It's obvious they knew how many of us there were, though. If they keep coming, it'll be because they believe they've got the strength to win."
She nodded, her face tight with fear, and he reached out to take her hand in both of his.
"I don't know if we can stop them."
His voice was harsh, saw-toothed with intensely personal worry, as he made himself admit the thing he feared most in all the world.
"If we can't..."
He broke off, jaw clenching, and she squeezed his hand. "If you can't," she told him, "it will only be because no mortal man could have. I know that, Edward. I've never doubted it." His mouth tightened further, and he drew a deep breath.
"We don't know what it is they want, Your Majesty, not for certain. Oh, we know they want you, but they may well want you alive, not dead."
"Do you really think that, Edward?" she asked gently. "Or are you just trying to reassure me?"
"I think it really is possible,"
he told her levelly, letting her see the truth in his eyes.
"Even likely. They haven't tried talking to us yet, so there's no way to know what they want. But I can think of a lot of ways you'd be most valuable to someone alive."
"Ways they could use me against Caleb or Karis or Chisholm, you mean?"
"Maybe, but even if they could, you'd still be alive, Your Majesty."
"At that high a cost?" She shook her head. "I've known since the day I took the throne that a queen or an empress is as mortal as anyone else, Edward. I've tried to live as a queen, and as someone who had no need to fear when the time came to face God. And a queen or an empress has a final duty to her subjects. I won't let myself be used against all that I love or the people I'm responsible for."
"Your Majesty," he began,
his voice starkly appealing, but she shook her head again. "No, Edward. How long have you known me? Do you truly think I would want to live at the cost of the sort of damage someone could use me to inflict on all the people who have trusted Caleb and me?" He gazed deep into her eyes and saw the truth, the determination, and the fear. There was no fatalism, no eagerness to embrace death, but neither was there panic. She wanted to live as desperately as he wanted her to, yet she meant exactly what she'd just said, and in that moment, despite his raw anguish over what was about to happen, he felt more pride in her than he'd ever felt before. He reached up and touched the side of her face with one hand. He hadn't touched her that way since she'd been a child, weeping with pain after a tumble from her horse had dislocated her shoulder, and she smiled in memory, despite her fear, as she pressed her cheek against his palm.
Your Majesty.
He had to pause and clear his throat.
Charlian, if I don't have the chance to tell you this later, it's been the greatest honor of my life to serve as your armsman. And your father would be very proud of you.
She squeezed his other hand more tightly, eyes bright with tears, and he drew a deep breath.
It's raining too hard for anyone to fire a rifle or a pistol out there, Your Majesty, he said more briskly. It's going to be bayonets and cold steel, but we've got 9 extra rifles and an entire stack of pistols.
He didn't have to explain why the rifles were extra, and she nodded in grim understanding.
They may not fire outside, he continued,
stepping over to the bedchamber's single window and using his mailed elbow to sweep every pane of expensive glass out of its frame.
But they'll fire just fine inside.
He leaned out to close the shutters, drew his dagger and cut a loophole in them, then turned back to her.
It won't stop a bullet or an arbalest bolt, Your Majesty, but it'll give you at least some concealment. And Daishan Teso's taken a leg wound. He's too unsteady to be much use outside, so I'm sending him in here to give you someone to reload.
Someone to reload for me, instead of the other way around? She asked with a faint gleam of humor, despite her fear. And he snorted.
Your Majesty, your uncle may not think it's a fitting hobby for a queen, but every man in your detachment knows you're a better shot than almost any of them are. And frankly, just now, I don't really care what your uncle may think about it.
Edward is right about that, Your Majesty, Father Carlson said. And I wish now that I'd learned to shoot one of these things. Unfortunately, I didn't. But if Daishan shows me how, I'm sure I can at least learn how to help him load them for you.
Reza's expression was strained, but he managed a crooked smile when she looked at him. Sea Hamper smiled back at him in approval, then looked around the bedchamber one last time before he stepped back.
I'll get Daishan in here with the rifles and pistols, Your Majesty.
Thank you, Edward.
She followed him to the door, then leaned close, rising on her toes, and kissed his bearded cheek.
I love you, she said softly.
I know, Your Majesty.
He touched her face once more.
I know.
All right, Mitron Divis said to Nihlus Larrak and Charles Abelin. We're all ready? The other two team leaders nodded. It had taken longer to get their men reorganized than they'd expected. On the other hand, the convent's isolation meant they had all night, and they might as well take the time to do it right. No doubt the guardsmen on the other side of the convent wall had been doing the same thing, and none of them were particularly happy about that thought, but there was only a limited amount Charlian's bodyguards could do. Larrak and Abelin had redistributed their remaining men to give each of them slightly less than half the strength with which they'd begun the night. Divus's so far unscathed team was still at full strength, which gave the Temple Loyalists a total of just over 150 men.
They've had time to recover from the surprise and get themselves organized again, Divus continued. They aren't going to go down easy. Be sure your men understand that.
Larrak and Abelin nodded again, although Abelin's eyes flickered with a touch of what might have been resentment. He didn't need Divus telling him what his own men had already discovered the hard way. Divus saw the other man's expression and started to say something else, then changed his mind. After all, if that was what Abelin was thinking, he had a point. All right, he said again instead, and smiled grimly as he pointed at the oilskin-wrapped powder charge fastened to the locked main gates. I'm pretty sure you'll both hear the signal to attack. Andrei Hoskins' head came up as a sudden thundercrack and blinding flash that owed nothing to the thunderstorm exploded in the darkness.
"Stand to!" he shouted.